This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from my home studio. My producer, Lee Delapina, back in our main studio in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. And as always, you are listening to this program live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to the free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and you're doing that through our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Really happy to have you along for the next hour, as today's guest has returned to training following an eight-year hiatus. He spent 10 years on the backside, training from 2002 to 2012. That, however, is only a very small part of his story. The son of a highly successful Irish-born trainer, grew up idolizing his father and eventually followed in his footsteps, first as a Grade 1 winning steeplechase rider, then as a trainer. But as you'll hear over the course of the next hour, he is a man of many talents, both on and off the racetrack. And if you've ever tuned in to one of our race broadcasts here on the network, or maybe you've watched one of your favorite commercials, you may be surprised at just how well you know this man's voice. Please join me in welcoming trainer Keith O'Brien to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here today. Keith, thanks for taking some time, my friend.
Oh, Mike, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for that very eloquent introduction.
Well deserved, and I think people will realize that as we make our way through the show this afternoon. And when I say the last name O'Brien, people may have already put the pieces together, but your father, Leo O'Brien, who is now retired, phenomenal career, and sad to see him step away from it, but that allows you to return to training, picking up some of his horses. We'll talk about the influence that your dad has had on you, both personally and professionally, but first of all, let's start with the present and tell me about where you are now and making a return to training.
In the cards last year, my dad had mentioned to me, you know, that he just needs to slow down a bit. You know, he's been doing this his entire life, and he's now 80. So we discussed it, and then I said, sure, you know, I'll take over the reins. I mean, we don't have a very big stable, so it wasn't like I was tackling, you know, 100 horses or anything. So, and I've, you know, and I've also been doing this my entire life, so it's not really a huge leap for me.
Did you always have it in the back of your mind that when your dad was finally ready to step down, you might step back in and take over?
To be honest with you, no, because, you know, I had trained before, but training, it's a very arduous, you know, career. And hearkening back to way back when, I wasn't really keyed in on becoming a trainer, because I know how difficult it is, and it's a 7 days a week sort of lifestyle. So it really wasn't in the forefront of my mind, but, you know, I've worked with my dad for my whole life. And as you said, I mean, I idolize him, so I said, you know what, I'm going to take it over, and I'm going to give it a run again and see if we can do some good. And if not, you know, I'll just step away.
How many horses do you have now?
Right now I have 7.
All right, so that's an easy number to start with, right?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, and the beauty of it is, I mean, I still ride, so, I mean, I get on all of them myself. So that's which can be a blessing, and it can also be a curse.
Yeah, how come?
Well, you know, I mean, kind of tongue-in-cheek there. You know, when you get on them yourself, you get to know how they feel, and sometimes you're not too happy. Or you get to, you can gauge their ability, and you think, oh, boy, this guy's got a case of the slows. How do I fix it?
But isn't it good, though, that you do get to know if there's something going on right away? Isn't that kind of an advantage?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, that's the way I was brought up. You know, I mean, riding has always been sort of central to my, you know, involvement in horse racing. I mean, my dad, obviously, he rode, and he got on. And even when he was a steeplechase jockey, he was an exercise rider to the stars in the late 60s, early 70s, and he used to get on all the very tough, roguey horses in New York and get them going correctly. And then he worked for Frank Whiteley, Elliot Birch, all those Hall of Fame trainers. So I always looked at riding as sort of that's the real representation of horsemanship. So then that's kind of where the angle where I come from.
Yeah, your dad grew up in Dublin, Ireland. I can remember he joined me on this program back on August 26th of 2015. And as we just mentioned, he has now stepped away, now retired. You know, I hadn't even realized that your dad officially retired because there wasn't a whole lot of hoopla and fanfare regarding his retirement. But you look back on his career, Keith, and you're talking about a man who saddled 568 winners that earned more than $27 million in purses, and to this day, the only American-based winner of a European Classic when Four Stars All-Star won the Irish 2000 Guineas in 1990. What a resume your dad racked up.
Yeah, it is. When you hear it like that, it sounds pretty cool. Definitely, the thing he's most proud of, though, is winning the 2000 Guineas.
I'm sure that was a special moment. What do you remember about that day?
Well, would you believe I was actually plying my trade as a jump jockey that day, and I was at a place called Radnor, Pennsylvania, riding over jumps. And my dad, I'd spoken to him several times during the week, and the lady I was working for at the time, Janet Elliott, she had called and found out that he won, and then they announced it over the intercom system. So it's kind of cool. But I actually remember, I remember when my dad told me what he was going to do in the previous fall. He said to me, he said, "Keith, you know, I'm going to take this horse to the Irish 2000 Guineas." And I said, "What? Well, why are you going to do that, Dad? That's crazy. That's insane." He said, no, this is the horse. I think this horse can win the 2000 Guineas." And I thought, really? I said, "Come on, Dad. It's got to be a little bit of a dream." But he was determined to take that horse, and he felt he was good enough. And by golly, he was right.
Yeah, he was right. That was a fantastic race by Four Stars All-Star. And as you said, probably the thing that your dad was most proud about when he finally retired, again, very, very recently. What led to his decision to retire, Keith?
You know, to be honest, you know, he's 80 now. He's been doing this his whole life. You know, my mom is, you know, facing some health issues. So he just kind of thought, you know, it's time for him to step away. So we discussed it a little bit, not a ton. And he said, "You know, if you'd like to take over, you can." So, and I said, "Well, you know what, Dad, why not? I'm going to try and leave somewhat of a legacy for myself if I can."
Yeah, I mean, you look back, again, sticking with your dad here for just a minute, and we could talk about him for the full hour, no doubt about it, but you look back at, you know, some of the names that your dad had the privilege to be around when he was training, and names like Four Star Dave, he handled his career, and Four Stars All-Star, mm-hmm. we just talked about, and one of my favorite fillies of all time, Yanks Music. I can remember watching her strut her stuff, and what'd she win, about four grade ones or something?
Yeah, four grade ones as a three-year-old.
Yeah, she was spectacular.
She really was.
Yeah,
and she was a tough cookie too to ride. She was not a straightforward filly at all.
Really?
Yeah, she was. When we had her obviously as a 2 year old, and she developed this habit of lugging out something awful, and like she would actually, Jean Cougay worked her one day in Saratoga before she had ever ran, and she was working on the main track and she bolted with him, and I tell you, scared the life out of him. He came back ashen white and said, "Oh, she's crazy." So I thought, really? I thought, man. So I started to get on her then, and by golly, she was. I mean, she would, if you tried to go and get into a battle with her, she would bolt. So we figured out that the best way to ride her was not to touch her mouth. So basically, we kind of I learned to just drop everything. When she would sort of grab the bit on the inside of her mouth, I would just drop everything. And then she might go for a couple of strides, and then, oh, okay, and settle in. And that was the same thing when Johnny rode her. Like, he rode her in the acorn. She was lugging something awful. No, excuse me, the mother goose. She was lugging something awful around the final turn, and she still won, but she definitely could have won easier. So we kind of discussed with him, and Johnny learned to ride her absolutely beautifully. I mean, just never touch her mouth, sit on her nice and quiet, and when you would grab her and chirp to her, she would really accelerate.
That is amazing to me. I mean, the way that different horses have these different personality traits and different traits that that come out when the rider is aboard, and you learn these things. And it's like, I guess, Keith, I'd liken it to raising a child, right? You're trying to figure out what the best approach is to get them in a position to be successful.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and she's like a fine example. I mean, if it hadn't been caught in time, it could have developed into like an impossible thing to deal with. You know, when horses bolt, it can be a little scary. You know, but kind of learned about her and learned her temperament, learned her personality, and said, oh, okay, this is the way she is. All righty, we can work with that. And then, sure enough, she turned out to be so bloody good.
Yeah, I still probably have pictures of her in a photo album somewhere. I used to go to Saratoga and just bring a camera and take pictures of the horses in the post parade and in the paddock. I'm sure I probably have Yanks music in there because I loved her. I mean, she won 7 of 9 starts. She had 2 seconds, so never worse than second in those 9 tries, and earned over, well, nearly $800,000. Just amazing.
She was something else. And actually on her too, she was an amazing filly on race day. When she would walk from the barn to the paddock, you know, she'd just walk normally, but as soon as she hit the paddock, I swear, she was like a boxer about to go into the ring. She would get up on her toes and she would just kind of lightly dance, like, okay, I'm here at the show and I'm ready for action. And she was really something spectacular when I look back on her.
Talking with trainer Keith O'Brien here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. If you're just joining us, taking over for his father, Leo, who is now retired. Keith starting with 7 horses in the stable, and we'll see where it goes from here. But he is back in action and training after that 10-year hiatus. Thinking about some of the other outstanding horses that your dad had the privilege to train, who are some of the others that stand out? I'm going to assume and go out on a limb that a horse named 4-Star Dave is probably prominent on that list.
Yes, he is. Without 4-Star Dave, there wouldn't have been a 4-Stars also. There wouldn't have been probably a Yanks Music. I mean, he really is the one that he put Pop back on the map. You know, I mean, we were a very small outfit at the time. And, you know, he came to us not really with, you know, much hoopla because, you know, he was by compliance and he was out of an unraced mare, Broadway Joan. And we had had one foal from that mare before, and he was actually a decent horse. He was a horse called 5-Star Howie. And, no, excuse me, Broadway, he was the horse before that was Jones Dancer. And he had won one race, and then he got hurt. So then Dave came to us, and we thought, okay. And he was very nervous. He was lanky, but he was fast. So we thought, okay, you know, this horse might be all right. So when we had him, Dad started working, and Dad, at that time, when we had a few horses, we used to work the 2-year-olds in behind all the time. You know, they'd get dirt in their face, and they'd learn to come up the inside, come up between horses, trying to get them as much experience before they raced. And this horse was doing really well. So Dad decided, you know what, I think this horse is a horse we could actually have a bet on first time out. So we said, oh, yeah, absolutely, Dad, why not? And anyway, so we entered him. And they had the jockey, oh my gosh, I can't remember his name. I'm showing my age here. had worked him, oh Lord. But the day before, anyway, he was going to run. He had a habit of pawing when the feed cart would come out. And one day, he's pawing, and didn't get his foot caught on the side of the stall, and he got a cut. Nothing terrible, but he had a cut. So the next day, when he was racing, my dad decided to have 3 bandages on the horse. So he had obviously the 2 rundown bandages, and then he put a bandage on the leg with the little nick. So when he went up to the paddock, it looked kind of odd. You see, this horse with 3 bandages. What is the deal here? So sure enough, and I think he went off at like 5-1, and my dad had a sizable bet on him.
Good for him. Yeah, four-star date. The Sultan of Saratoga. He won a race each year from 1987 to 1994. Think about that. That's remarkable. You know, Keith, I'm pretty sure that I do. I do have a picture, and I'm not ashamed to say this. I have a picture of me signing a get well card for Four Star Dave that Naira had put up at Saratoga when he was trying to make his way back from an injury.
Oh yeah, yep. And that was 95.
Yeah, yeah. And then he had, didn't he have three chances to extend the streak in 95 too?
Yeah, that was the end of it. Because 94 was the last year he won up there, and then that year he was actually in the race. It was in the Bernard Baruch, and he was racing against Paradise Creek and Lure, and he had won obviously in the beginning of the meet. And that particular day, back then they still allowed you to run on the turf with stickers, turn downs, and the turf was really, really rough. It was terribly rough by the time the Bernard Baruch was run. And, unfortunately, he was in front running a hell of a race, and somewhere around the final turn, Richard Migliore, who was on him that day, he stepped in a hole, and then he felt, as he pulled up, I said, uh-oh, something happened. So he fractured his ankle in the running of the race and still managed to finish third to Paradise Creek and Lure.
Yeah, salty race and a courageous effort by four-star Dave. And the day that he finally passed away, he did it on the racetrack. I can remember he died of a heart attack, if I'm not mistaken, on the track. And Keith, you know that better than anybody.
Yeah, that was terrible. I mean, they were doing a nice thing. It was for the New York Bread Showcase Day in the fall, and he was 16. And they brought him up, and they wanted to parade him before the races. So he came up, and we gave him a jog the day before, 2 days before. And then the day before, another jog. But he was kind of a worrywart, and he was a very intense horse, and he was very smart. And I think he thought, oh my God, they're going to race me. And it was just a little bit too much for his heart. And he ended up, he had a heart attack. He came back, he went out for a jog, came back to the barn, and had a heart attack and died.
Yeah.
Kind of something
sad.
Like almost like that happened to Kelso, if you remember. At Kelso, they paraded him, I guess, in 82, 83. And then when he went back to the farm, he had a heart attack and died. So sometimes those old geldings, they've given so much on the track, and then they get competitive. They get that natural competitive spirit. And it was just a little bit too much for his heart, though.
Yeah, he was a special horse. How about a couple of the others that you're always going to remember for whatever reason?
Let me see. Well, there's a horse that probably most people wouldn't know unless you're involved in jump racing. But my dad, when we came back from Ireland in 1981, we came back with one horse, and it was a jumper called Sports Reporter that was owned by Richard Bomsey, who obviously he owned Four Star Day, Four Star All Star, and he brought him back, and he won the International Gold Cup in October of 1982 down at a place called Ligonier. And he kind of got Dad back here, back in New York. And it was kind of funny. He was training with one jumper at Belmont Park in the 80s. And he was getting on horses, making the rounds. And that horse, I have a lot of fond memories of him. And actually, the other horse there that I think, one of my all-time favorites, is a horse called Valley Victory that my dad had.
Sure.
She won the Coaching Club American Oaks in, I think it was 1986, yes. And so it was a horse came from. It was actually an Irish bred. She had won a Grade Three on the turf, and I can't remember the man's name. There was a trainer, an Irish trainer in California, and they ran her here in the Mother Goose, and she finished fourth. And then they said they wanted to run her in the Coaching Club American Oaks, but John didn't want her to run in his name, so he said, "Well, why don't you give her to Leo? Because he's a good little horseman. He'll take care of her and he'll run her." So we got this filly 3 weeks before the Coaching Club of Oaks. And she was a tall, skinny thing. And I was 17 at the time, so I was starting to gallop, so my dad put me on her. And she was kind of nervous, and she would gallop very nice. But the thing about her, we were in barn 40 at Belmont Park, and she had a stall right in front of the tack room. And every morning after work, I would be cutting the carrots in the tack room, and she would watch me cutting the carrots every day. And she seemed to enjoy that, and it slowly started, got a little bit more settled. And we had also then had a hot walker at the time. His name was Tommy Quinn, and an old race tracker who galloped Bold Ruler, he galloped Buck Passer, worked for Sonny Jim, and he would hot walk her every morning, and he would just sing to her. And for whatever reason, Randy Romero then rode her, and again, some very good fillies. There was a filly called Lotka, Life at the Top of Wayne Lucas's. It was back when he was training for Eugene Klein. Anyway, she went out there, broke second, third, hit the stretch. She won by about 10, and my legs turned to jelly that day. I'll never forget it. That was one of the most special days ever.
Yeah,
Valley victory. It was also my dad's first grade one as a trainer.
Wow. Yeah, that had to be a very special day. And another, just one of several special moments in the career of trainer Leo O'Brien. And I'm visiting with his son, Keith O'Brien, here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Keith, you referenced the fact that your family came back from Ireland in 1981. So let's go ahead and step back to the beginning here for a minute. And take me back to your childhood. Let's work our way up through, and we'll kind of circle back to that in a minute. But take me back to the beginning. Where did this love begin? You were obviously born into it.
Yeah, I mean, I was. I was born in the 60s. My dad, on the day I was born, my dad won what's gone now, the old Saratoga steeplechase on a horse called Apollon in 1968. And so I've been going to Saratoga basically since I was born. and then, I grew up watching my dad ride. I remember going to the hunt meets, and I adored my dad, obviously, and I adored jump racing. I just loved the hunt meets. I loved to watch them. I loved to be involved with the jockeys. And then my dad, we were living in New York in 1976, and my dad, he had decided... My uncle, Michal, had been paralyzed 2 years prior in the fall, in the steeplechase fall. Actually, the horse had a heart attack in midair during the race, and he was paralyzed as a result of the fall. Mm. And him, my father, and my uncle, Michal, had decided that they were going to go back to Ireland at the end of 1976, and they were going to start training, and my dad would ride. Well, unfortunately, my dad was injured in the fall of 1976 at Monmouth Park. He fractured his skull, had a terrible, terrible injury, and so that curtailed his riding career. But he had decided, he had committed to go to Ireland, so we went back to Ireland at the end of 1976, and he started training with my uncle. And they had some tremendous years. They really had some great years. They were training for the likes of George Strawbridge. Rusty Carrier had some, who were from Pennsylvania, had some wonderful horses. My uncle became, and my dad, they became champion trainer in Ireland in 1980. And after that, my dad decided, okay, it's time for me to go back to the United States and make my own mark. So that's when we went back. But actually, at the time, I didn't really like Ireland when I was a kid, but I appreciate it now, because if I had never have gone to Ireland, I never would have got to know a lot of my relations, my grandparents, obviously. So I look back on that fondly now, even though at the time it was a little bit of a chore.
Yeah.
But gave me a lot of, because they were based on the Curragh. They had Rathbride Stables. And I used to go up with my dad. We lived about 40 minutes away, so I would always, drive up with him. And I would ride racing ponies and stuff, get run off with across the Curragh, fall off. But it definitely gave me an appreciation and a deep love for just horses and just, and training and just being around them,
After seeing what happened with your dad and his injury when he was riding, and of course your uncle, you just talked about him and his situation being paralyzed, why would you be so adamant about wanting to ride races after watching that happen?
That's a great question. And I've asked myself that, too. I think as I look back on it, a lot of it had to do with, I wanted to be like my dad. I was one of those sons, so I just wanted to be like my dad no matter what. It didn't matter what it was, but I just wanted to be like him. And there was also a part of me that just wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. I have a little bit not ego, but, you know, it's not, riding over jumps is not for everybody, and there's not a lot of people who can do it or do it well. And so I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it, you know? And that's basically why. You know, the injuries of my dad and my uncle never really crossed my mind, you know? I mean, that was, you know, just racing. Racing's a hard game. It's a tough game, you know, and things happen, accidents happen. So that, I mean, if you start thinking, if you're thinking about that injuries before you even start, then there's no point in doing it, you know?
Yeah, and you were fortunate. You didn't really have any severe injuries, right?
No, yeah, thank God. I'm fine. A couple of concussions, nothing major.
Oh, just a couple of concussions. Everybody gets those. It's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, I always used to kid our colleague, a good friend of mine who worked with us for many, many years, Sean Clancy, who you may have ridden mm-hmm. with, actually.
I rode with Sean for many years.
Yeah, Sean was a tremendous steeplechase jockey, and whenever he would say something on air that didn't quite make sense, I'd just mention that it must have been one of the concussions talking rather than him. But, yeah, I mean, obviously nothing to joke about, but yeah, great stuff.
No, I mean, I'm not jesting. I'm just
yeah.
sort of making
yeah.
fun of myself.
Yeah, of course. You know, your big win as a rider, I guess, came at Saratoga, didn't it? The New York Turf Riders Cup, wasn't that in Saratoga?
Yeah, that was. It was for a dear friend of our family's, Tom Voss, trained it. And it was owned by Peter Schiff at the time. Horse called Petrovsky. He's a really, really good horse.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day, about that win?
I remember, actually, that was one of those things where I wanted to win the big race at Saratoga. You know, and when I felt if once I won that, I'd be like, okay, that's it. You know, I'm happy with that. And he was going into that race. He was training because I was working for Tom Voss at the time. He was training lights out, and I thought to myself, you know, as long as I don't fall off, this horse will win. And the whole race, he was basically just dragging me the entire way. I was just sitting on him the entire time, just holding him, just waiting to let him go. And then when I turned for home with one fence to go, I let him go, gave him a chirp, he flew the last and won. And when I pulled up, my two buddies, Sean and Chip Miller, came up on either side of me and high-fived me because they kind of knew how much it meant to me to win the Turf Riders and to win at Saratoga. It was just it was definitely a moment that I savored.
Yeah, talking with trainer Keith O'Brien, again, former steeplechase jockey, son of trainer Leo O'Brien, who is now retired. He has taken over that string and is out on his own again for a second stint at training horses. I'll continue this visit right after this short commercial break. Stay with me. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Hello, I'm Michael Blowen, founder of Old Friends Thoroughbred Retirement Farm. One of our highest priorities for these living legends is safety. That's why the fence we trust most at Old Friends is the V-Mesh Keepsake from Red Brand. Keepsake features a V-Mesh weave to prevent hooves from getting caught, and the mesh design flexes on impact. Learn more about the quality, safety, and long-lasting value of Keepsake V-Mesh Horse Fence by visiting redbrand.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Now it's Star of Gdansk, four stars, all star on the near side, and they're a long way clear of Ganges and Lysias inside the final furlong. It's on the far side, Star of Gdansk, four stars, all star on the near side, as it race up towards the finish, four stars, all star on the stand side. A Star of Gdansk, and the American Hawks is going to win it. Four stars, all star, wins the Guineas.
Four Stars All-Star winning the 2000 Guineas in 1991, trained by Leo O'Brien, still the only American trainer to this date to win a classic race in Europe, and it was very, very impressive. What a stretch run by Four Stars All-Star, and if you are just tuning into the program, well, welcome back. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with trainer Keith O'Brien here this morning, the son of Leo, and he mentioned in the first half of the program that was probably the one moment that his dad is most proud of, and rightfully so. It was a very, very special moment back in 1991. If you did miss any portion of this program, want to remind you that all you have to do is head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. The podcast of this show and all of our shows is available for you to listen to at your leisure. It's all there, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, another way you can experience your Horse Racing Radio Network. Well, Keith, that was definitely a special moment. You touched on some of the other moments that stood out to you when you were working with your dad. Now you're out on your own and you're training again. Talk a little bit about your approach to training and the way that, you get horses ready to go to the races.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, I like to take my time. You know, I really do. I like to be patient, you know, and that is largely hinges upon the owners that you have, and thankfully the owners and the few owners I have right now, they're very patient and they're willing to listen and to understand. You know, let's find out what the horse is made of, what makes them tick, and just kind of take our time and try and find the right spots. You know, I think I'm not a big speed guy, but at the same time, I do have one horse called Long Twist, and he's a very fast horse, and fast horses will breeze fast, so that's not something I look for. But, you know, I don't take away what comes naturally to a horse, you know. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of training and philosophies and styles, it might sound like a cliche, but I really do, I treat each one of them differently, and I have a different approach for each one. I mean, I ride them myself, so each morning, you know, I do something different with each one of them. You know, I might go to the pony track with one, I might take a horse to the paddock, jog around the main track, then I might go to the training track, gallop, go for a long hack. You know, I mean, when you're a small outfit, you can kind of do those sort of things, and especially when you ride them yourself. You know, and then also, you know, obviously a feed program. You know, horses, these are athletes, so they need their calories. In order to train correctly, they need calories that you can turn into muscle and hopefully stamina and develop them, you know, like a professional athlete, like they are.
Yeah, you know, as I was getting ready for the program, I read an article, an interview that you did on another website, I believe it was irishcentral.com. I want to make sure I give them the credit. And it was a few years back, and one of the things you mentioned, you said that you're not fascinated by the gambling, but you relish the sport and the physical and mental challenges it presents. What can you elaborate on that? What are some of those challenges?
I grew up in the game. When I was a kid, and even, oh my God, when I was a teenager, and even now, I would go to the races, and I would go to the paddock. I'd watch the horses in the paddock. I'd watch them in the post-parade, watch the race. And then I loved to watch them gallop back after the race. I was never really sort of in tune to going to the races to cash a bet, you know? I mean, every now and again, I would bet, but I was more focused on the jockey and the horse. Trying to find, you're looking at them as individuals, each horse. What makes them tick? You know, why does this one run this way? You know, like with Yang's music, you know, why would she have developed a habit of bolting like that as a two-year-old who never ran and who wasn't sore? You know, there's different things. If you can get as much as you can into the mind of a horse and try and figure out, okay, this is what makes them happy. This is what makes them tick. This is what they like to do. You know, like basically sometimes you'll see horses on the inside, and you think, well, why aren't they going? Well, some horses don't like to run on the inside. They like to run on the outside, and vice versa. Some horses love to get in between horses and split horses and come with a big kick. The challenge for me with horses, although it's very challenging, it's, you know, when you find that niche of a horse what they like to do, how they like to train. It's kind of gratifying. And then if you can finally get them into the winner's circle, that's just gravy, you know? I do enjoy that part. You know, I still enjoy, even though I'm 51, I still enjoy riding. I still enjoy trying to figure out that, what makes this horse happy? You know, and sometimes I never find out, but when you do find out, you think, oh, wow, okay, this is the thing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. How long does it usually take you to learn a horse's personality when you start getting on them or you start working with them as a trainer?
It takes a while, you know, it takes a few months, you know, I mean, there's no fast way to do it, you know, I mean, you can get a sense of a horse quickly, an instinct might tell you, but, you know, it really does, it's a relationship, like you said earlier with a child, you know, as a child is growing, you know, you find out different idiosyncrasies of their personality, you know, when they're challenged, you know, when they come up against, you know, tough times, you know, see how do they react, and the same with horses. Some horses, you know, will take it and they'll, okay, go forward. And other horses, oh God, you know, this is too much for me. I can't do this. You know, just like a person, just like a child. And you have to try and find that what will give them the confidence to then perform, you know. I mean, I definitely have found over the years that there's no one way to make a horse, you know, win. there's so many different styles, different thoughts about it, different philosophies, but the only constant is the horse. So whatever it is about that horse that's going to make him the best horse he can be, if you can find that, then you've really done your job. I mean, and I think with a smaller outfit like I have at the moment, it's easier to do, but yet at the same time, sometimes you find that, well, you know, this horse is just not very fast.
Yeah. What's the key to being a good horse trainer, Keith?
Well, I suppose, you know, there'd be a lot of... Nowadays, it's sad for me to say, but it has changed dramatically. You know, when I was young, I always thought that trying to be the best horse person you can be was the ultimate way to success. You know, you manage your horse, you deal with the horse, you train the horse. But nowadays, with the large numbers that so many, well, not so many, but a few outfits have, and it's become sort of a process of elimination. You know, you churn through these horses, and you find the beauty ones, the really good ones. They rise to the top, and those are the marquee or the showcase horses. So a lot of what I grew up admiring is not even considered anymore. I mean, when I look back, like you mentioned earlier, like Frank Whiteley, you know, Sidney Waters, Woody Stevens, I mean, these old-time horsemen, you know, they never had more than 30 or 35 horses at a time, you know, in their stable, because they said, quite frankly, there's no way one person can keep an eye on more than that. You know, you can't know, if you have 150 horses, there's no way on earth you know all their personalities. I mean, that's just, it's physically impossible. You know, so it's become really more of a managerial job nowadays. It's almost like, you know, you're a hedge fund portfolio manager. You know, you're managing your horses as commodities and saying, okay, well, this horse is valued at this, and this is where he's going to run. And it's taken away, for me, it's taken away that sport. I mean, I understand it's a business. It's always been a business. It always will be a business. But it's taken away that sport, that flavor of, like, oh, you know, the twinkle that you could see in somebody's eye, you know? And then that, I think, is missing, and I'd love to see that come back, but who knows if it will, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe it's just me being a little nostalgic.
Well, with that said, and that's a fair point, with that said, where do you hope this new journey takes you?
You know what? I'd like to win a few grade ones myself. You know, I'd like to be lucky enough to train some good horses for some good people, and win a couple of grade ones, you know. I mean, I don't have any illusions of looking for 250 horses and setting records like that. I just like to have some nice horses, to develop the horses, allow the horses to speak for me, you know. That's ultimately what I would like to do. And just to show that, yes, I'm a good horseman. I know what I'm doing. But I, like anybody, you need the raw material to work with.
Talk
my uncle used to say, You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ears.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. Visiting, by the way, with trainer Keith O'Brien here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Were your parents big on making sure that you completed your education before you really went down this road full steam ahead?
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. You know, that was a very important thing, and I'm very grateful for them. I mean, like I did, I was lucky enough to graduate from Holy Cross. I've got a bachelor's degree in political science that I'm putting to such good use. but it was always something that they wanted to do. I mean, my parents, when she was, my dad, he left school when he was 12. My mom left school when she was 16. So the whole collegiate experience, they had no idea what it was, but they wanted me and my sister Leona to go to college and graduate college. And if we like the horse racing business, then sure, of course you can enter it, but always to have something to fall back on. So I'm still, I have that to fall back on, but I'm still waiting to fall back.
What's it like to have John Velasquez as your brother-in-law?
Yeah, he's pretty cool. He's a nice guy. Very nice guy. You know, Johnny, from the first day I met him, which was actually when I was riding over jumps, I met him in Saratoga, and he didn't speak much English at all. He only had a few words, but I was struck from the very moment I met him. He came over to me and introduced himself because he said, "You know, I'm dating your sister." I said, "Oh, okay. Hey, how you doing, man? How's it going?" He was always very polite, always an absolute gentleman from the day one. The man is a gentleman. And he still is to this day. He's one of the nicest, most genuine people that I could ever wish to meet. I mean, and if you have a sister and when she gets married, I mean, there's no better man than Johnny. And that's the truth. I'm not just saying that because he's Johnny Velasquez. If he was Johnny Velasquez, you know, the investment broker or whatever, I would say the same thing. He's just a really, really good, honest human being.
Yeah, I've said that from day one about guys like John Velasquez and Ramon Dominguez and people like that that are equally as good off the racetrack as they are on the racetrack,
yeah.
If not better. They might be better people than they are jockeys. And, of course, we're talking about your sister Leona, who married Johnny, and they have a wonderful family, beautiful kids, and it's great to see that relationship come together, and now your relationship too.
Oh yeah, you know, we've always gotten along very well, you know, always. Although I will say, to be honest with you, I've been a bit chagrined lately because I can't seem to get Johnny for any of my horses.
Well, that was my next question. Are you going to try and get him on some of those horses?
Yeah, I mean, I've actually I tried to get him for a couple, and unfortunately, you know, Mr. Mott and Mr. Pletcher, they have slightly better horses, so the agent picked otherwise.
Hey, come on, you have to do what you do for family.
I understand the game. I mean, I grew up in the game, so, I mean, the agent is trying, it's his job to get his jockey on the best horse in the race, so if he feels it's somebody else, then it is. So there's no, it would never become personal. You know, racing is the job, is the business, so that's where that relationship stays, you know.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful to see. And by the way, Keith O'Brien here on
Trainer Talk. If I may add, a few years ago, when my son, he was he endured some horrific bullying at school, and you know, Johnny really, he showed his true colors to me. Then he kind of stepped forward, and I don't know if you recall, but he won the Breeders' Cup Distaff that year, and he wore an orange band around his leg to bring attention to bullying, You know, that's a moment that I will never, ever forget. He did that for my son, Liam. Nobody asked him to. He didn't tell anyone he was going to do it. He just did it. And that sort of encapsulates the kind of person and man that Johnny is.
Yeah, all of the jockeys ended up wearing them, didn't they?
They did the following day.
Yeah.
They did, you know, but that was on the Friday with the distaff. He did that. I mean, I had no idea. I was watching the race and cheering for him, and I see him wearing this orange band. I'm like, who am I that for? silly me. And then when he pulled up and he said it, I said, wow, holy cow. That's something else. That's some kind of person.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And that chapter a few years ago for you and for your wife, Keith, was just horrifying. And to have a 13-year-old boy go through that type of of abuse and bullying, and eventually had to be hospitalized to treat his depression and his eating disorder. I can only imagine how difficult that must have been.
Yeah, that was definitely a low point, you know. But it was a tough time. But thankfully, you know, he's doing well now. You know, he's back in school, and he's actually hoping to play football this year. Although I keep saying to him, you better start pumping some iron now.
What do you say to other parents who might be going through that same situation?
I say, you know what, you talk, be as open as possible you can with your children. You know, you have to be aware of every moment, every sort of mood that they have, and you got to know who their friends are. I mean, today it's very difficult, almost because of the social media aspect. You know, I mean, I remember with Liam, one of the beginning signs that we saw something was wrong is he gave his phone, his cell phone. The 12-year-old boy said, I don't want this anymore. I said, what? You don't want your cell phone? And, you know, and he just said, oh, there's too much drama. You know, I mean, I wish when I look back now, I think I should have dug deeper. You know, but it's very difficult for children. I mean, back in my day, you know, you could go around behind school and have a little fisticuffs, and you'd settle it, and then, you know, you'd end up beating each other up, but you might be buddies in the end. But nowadays, it's a lot more insidious, and it's very dangerous. You know, I can only say that when they're your children, you got to be aware, you got to know everything you can about them and protect them at all costs.
Yeah, well, thankfully, little Liam is doing well, and you and your family are back on track again after that horrifying episode a few years back. Let's turn our attention, Keith, to one of your other passions, and that is voice acting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, voice acting is something that I've always had a passion for. You know, I was one of those kids who was brought up on Saturday morning cartoons, you know, your Scooby-Doos, your Jabberjaws. I loved cartoons. You know, I used to love to imitate voices and not imitate people. And I actually always wanted to be an actor too. it was an ambition of mine. You know, and of course life gets in the way, you know, and then I wanted to be a jump jockey and all that stuff and horse racing. And about 10 years ago, it was kind of like, you know, things weren't really going very well in terms of training. Horse business was sort of drying up, and I just started to explore acting classes, you know, and said, you know what? If I never do this, I will regret it. So let me at least open myself up and see if there's something else out there. So I started taking some acting classes, and I found I really enjoyed it. You know, if for nothing else, it was almost cathartic. You know, it was like you could explore your own self and become someone else and really enjoy it. And also then I found out I had a little bit of a talent for it. So I was like, oh, wow, this is really cool. And you can actually make money at it. Of course, it's not as easy as that, but because it's a highly competitive game, like everything. But I really enjoy acting, and that's really what voice acting is. It's just acting behind a microphone in a little space, in this little cubbyhole. It's you, the microphone, the director in your ear, and your imagination. And that's one thing that I've always had a plethora of, not the imagination. I can dream with the best of them. I can make things up with the best of them.
What are some of the favorite things that you've done?
Pardon me?
What are some of your favorite things that you've done?
You know, I love to do the characters. I did a Chobani commercial a couple of years ago that was on Nickelodeon. I love that because you kind of get to be a little bit goofy, and it was for kiddies. I love to play the characters. You know, I've played different characters in commercials and different characters in video games, although the video games is hard work, you know, because there's a lot of screaming, there's a lot of fighting and things like that. But the characterization, and there's like a story, there's an arc to these video games now. There's a storyline that you can follow. So it's really like movie making, you know, in a lot of these things. So you're playing a character from A to B, you know. You're not just being a funny voice, like, oh, hey, I've got to good to talk to you. How are you doing? You know, there has to be something behind it, you know. There's a character, a person, a living, breathing person. And that's kind of And I tell you, to be honest with you, the racetrack is a fantastic place to draw from. There are so many characters that you meet in horse racing. And you can just take a little bit of these different people and you create your own character out of that, you know?
Can you give me an example of something you've done, a little voice work here on the show? Give me an example of something you've done that's fun, that you've really enjoyed.
Okay.
Nothing of putting you on the spot.
Yes, I know. I actually did something recently. It was a cartoon called The Big Top, and I played a German doctor. Now, the name of it has nothing to do with anything recently. But his name is Dr. Freudenstein, and he would talk like this. He's very intelligent, but he's also a little bit, you know, sometimes you'd wonder, what are his motivations? And I would do it like this because I thought, he's very cerebral, yet there's also that darkness about him. But then I said, well, okay, I will play this part like this. And that is what I did.
If you were going to pick something in racing and try to do some voice work or some type of fictional character involved in racing, you may have already done that, but if you were going to pick something or a topic or a person in racing and do something like that, what would it be? What would it sound like?
That's a good question, you know, because, it's funny you should say that because I've been writing this pilot that's set on the backstretch of a racetrack, and I kind of come up, there's so many different characters that you love. I mean, you know, you've got the Irish guy, you know, like the sort of the model after my dad, and he's a bit quiet, and he's a trainer, and he does things very, very quietly, like, you know, and then, you've got your, hey, what are you talking about? This horse is a good horse. He's a good horse, I'm telling you, man. This horse can run. And so there's so many different characters that you can sort of play, you know, that I can play, and it's kind of hard to pinpoint one, you know, to say, okay, this is the one. I kind of think that would have to be an amalgamation for me.
That's fantastic. Do you actually sit down, write a script before you do this, or is it something that just kind of flows as you go and you kind of take it from there?
Well, it depends. I mean, it really depends. I mean, like, just right now, no, I was just ad-libbed.
Well, of course.
Took it off the top of my head, you know. But, I mean, the different thing. Like I said, I've got a very good imagination. And actually, that's a great thing for acting and for life in general is taking improv classes. I've taken a bunch of those as well. And they're very freeing.
Yeah, well, I know you've done work for major clients such as Gatorade and Verizon, and you mentioned Nickelodeon and Audible. There have been some big names on your resume, and rightfully so. Of course, Horse Racing Radio Network fits right in there too, because you're our voice guy for our opening teasers that we produce for our broadcast, and you've been doing that for many years, and I can't thank you enough for all your hard work there because you do a tremendous job.
I really enjoy doing those for you.
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun, and it's something a little bit different. And, you know, who knows where this ends up taking you. Do you see yourself, Keith, up the road spending as much time doing the – I know you spend a lot of time with it now, but will you spend more time doing voice work or more time training horses, or will you try to blend the two?
Well, I mean, I'd like to be greedy, to be honest with you, and blend the two, you know. But the voice work is something that please God, you know, I can do until I'm way, way in my many years from now, you know, and training, I hope I can, but honestly, the economic realization of it is it's extraordinarily difficult to make a living in training, you know. I mean, unless you have some quality horses and quality owners, it's virtually impossible. So as much as I would like to, you know, I also have to be a bit of a realist. You know, and say, well, you know, if it's not going to work, I will be more of a voice actor, you know, in the future. But hopefully not. I mean, I really would like to continue to be in horse racing.
Yeah. How much time do you spend with the voice work now is probably a better way to say it.
Okay. Well, basically my day now is I'm training in the morning. riding, and basically till about 12, and then from 12 until 6 or 7, I'll be doing voice stuff, voice work. Sometimes I'll be doing workshops. Sometimes I'll be just training. Sometimes I'll be I audition every single day because I've built a little home studio in my parents' basement, and I've got something called Source Connect Standard, so I can basically be connected anywhere in the world live with someone. They can direct me live and they can record me live. So you don't actually have to, I mean, that's one of the, with the COVID outbreak recently, you know, the home studio and doing voice work has continued, thank God, you know. Like with voiceovers, you know, you're constantly, it's like anything, you're constantly learning, you're constantly challenging yourself. There's always new techniques, there's new things to learn, and there's new trends. And you have to be, like, as a voice actor, you have to be on top of the trends. You know, you can't be behind the eight ball. You have to be almost one step ahead. I mean, right now, it's very millennial. You know, it's very young-sounding, and thankfully, even though I'm older, I have got a young-sounding voice, so I'm able to fit in.
That's great. Keith O'Brien here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Keith, just about a minute and a half or so left before we have to wrap things up. This has been such an enjoyable visit. I always like to wrap it up by asking trainers to tell us a little something about them that people might not know. Now, we touched on the voice work. That's certainly something. But outside of those hobbies and those passions, are there other things that you become involved in or you follow?
Well, I'll give you two things, actually. I'm a huge New York Jets football fan.
Okay.
I love the New York Jets. And I played rugby in college, and I was actually alternate All-American my senior year.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I played scrum half, and I was invited to go in the summer of 1990 to go to San Diego to be on the U.S. team, and they were playing Canada. And I said, well, I was going to be the number two scrum half. I wasn't the starter. And I said, well, no, I want to be a steeplechase jockey. It's much safer. So that was my I actually love rugby. I love rugby. I still love it to this day. I don't play it now, of course, but I love to watch it, you know, the Six Nations tournaments and all that.
I told you, he's a man of many, many talents, and he is trainer Keith O'Brien, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Keith, listen, appreciate the visit, and all the best with the new string. Keep it rolling.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I really appreciate it, and I'm very thankful for having me.
All right, Keith O'Brien here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Don't forget, if you missed it, head over to our podcast, horseracingradio.net. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening.